Hello, friends, and welcome to the Healing Ground Movement. Now, for more content and bonus features, you can join us on Facebook and Instagram. And remember, all of our content is delivered freely, so please consider supporting the show by donating via the link on our website at healinggroundmovement.com or liking and reviewing the podcast on your favorite platform.
Enjoy today's episode.
Today's episode is brought to you by one of my all-time favorite apps, Linkist. I found out about this app when I was pregnant and didn't have as much time to read, particularly into those early years of mothering, and it has been a game changer. Linkist brings you knowledge from top nonfiction and podcasts so you can learn anytime, anywhere, and the best part is it condenses it down into 15 minutes. You can either listen or read to key ideas from best-selling nonfiction in just 15 minutes. So you keep getting all of these great recommendations, all the parenting books, all the health books, all of the things that you know you should be doing and know that you should know more about, but you just don't have the time to read the full version. You can get the Cliff Notes version from Blinkist. They have teamed up with podcast creators to bring you key insights from podcasts as well. And there is expert curation, their handpicked recommendation tailored to what you're interested in. So the more you listen, the more specific your recommendations get. Visit healinggroundmovement.com/resources for a free trial of Blinkist. I know you're going to love it as much as I do. Enjoy today's episode. Welcome to Healing Ground Movement Podcast. I am Dr. Carly Hudson, and I am so excited to dive into this conversation with Katie Strand because we already had like three amazing side conversations before she encouraged me to hit record because it is time to have this conversation. We're going to dive into some kind of heavy topics today, but it's the sort of conversation around healing and challenges and grief. Where, you know, we just use the phrase, we find poetry in the practicality of how we look at navigating these things. And I think it's a really important conversation for us to have as a community and to have with expansion and hope rather than that falling inward and conclusion. We're part of a cycle here. So before I get too far off topic on my own, let's introduce you to today's guest, Katie. Katie Strand became a widow in her 30s after 20 years of study in psychology and personal growth. Katie is an expert on grief, mental, emotional health, and transformation. She is also a songwriter, storyteller, dancer, director, producer, writer, host, coach, and Emmy-nominated documentary film producer. All informed and enhanced by her life experience and her work as a performer and coach. So here we have that storytelling and that richness of expression. Again, there's a theme happening. Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me. Should I call you Carly or Dr. Carly?
They know I'm a doctor. We can just have a conversation.
Okay, just in case I use your name. Okay. Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, so excited to have you. And with that really rich and varied background, can you give us your own version of your origin story of where you came to talking particularly about this grief and acceptance around all of this expressive art?
Mm. Ooh, okay. Feel free to interrupt me if I get long-winded. But I think one of the key components is that I was a very, very curious child. And as you know, most children are curious. And there was something in me that wasn't willing to let that be suppressed as I became an adult. And so as at 19, I did my first personal growth seminar. I also that same year started learning Kundalini yoga. And all that entails. And then of course was doing the college experience, and most of my peers were, you know, partying or going to spring break in wherever, like, you know, Mexico or somewhere, you know, I was in San Diego, so it was already a warm place. So some people would come to San Diego for spring break, where I was doing like week-long advanced seminars of like personal growth and spirituality. Yeah, I was definitely a little bit odd, but my experience with that early on in my young adult life actually was very empowering, and it engaged my curiosity so that I could go, oh, I can, instead of just feeling like I'm being reactive or just a pure participant in life, I can actually observe. I can observe my own thoughts, my response and reaction to things, and actually be empowered to look at the things that I'm thinking and saying to myself and believing about these, you know, interpersonal interactions or life experiences, and get clarity that my reaction is wholly based on all these different things, survival instinct, childhood stuff, and actually make a choice based on what's true, not based on the false narrative that's usually going on in most of our minds.
Yeah.
If that gives a good summary of that. So then I had this idea in my 20s that there was going to be a guy that was like into this kind of stuff too. And so I kind of would meet people through these, you know, personal growth seminars or through yoga or just through life, through dance. I'm a dancer. So I was like doing a lot of swing dancing and salsa and tango at the time. I do mostly partner dances. And I do some modern and other stuff too, but I love the partner dances. So I was doing a lot of that, meeting people through those communities and environments. This is still San Diego. And then in my mid to late 20s, I moved to LA. But I had this experience of relationship where, you know, the word manipulation is so charged, but it really was almost like I was interacting with these men and I was experiencing where they would want to blame me for their emotional state. You made me feel this, or you did this and I felt this. And it was like, that's so part of our culture. That's really, really common. But I just had this sense of like, I kind of want something different. I want a different experience with relationship. And so I never got like, I didn't get, you know, I didn't move in with anybody. I didn't get married. Kind of was avoidant of those things. So I wanted to really figure out who I was. And I had this hope that there would be somebody that was not like that. So I met Marcus in 2008 and he was not like that. And I met him in the context of being he was my martial arts teacher. And I just like, we would spend time together outside of class, but he never like made a move. He never made advances to me known that he had a romantic interest in me. He called it ninja dating, by the way. where you're kind of dating somebody, but they don't know you're dating them. And then all of a sudden, like you're in love with them, which is totally true. I was like in love with him. I was like, how did this happen? He's my teacher. And he's like, that's an awesome dude. But I didn't think of him in this way until I did. It took about 5 months.
I feel like that's kind of how my relationship started too. I love this ninja dating thing. It's like, accidentally.
One of these like elements of this story that's so rich to me. But essentially what I really experienced, and even you know, talk to my friends about, and they would like talk to him about it, is this person who is just so connected with self and self-aware and personally responsible that like I was free to express myself and to engage my curiosity with whatever thing I wanted to learn about, whether it was like, I really love science and physics and astronomy. So whether it was that stuff or, you know, my pursuits in music or dance or filmmaking, or whatever. And he just was this beautiful energy of just like, be you. Like the best way for me to love you is for you to be fully you, like fully expressed, fully like who you are. And he would just celebrate me and all my whims and whatever. And, you know, we were both working. He was teaching and coaching on nutrition and stuff like that. And I was working the film industry and still making music and doing my creative work. And so, you know, he had kidney issues when I met him. And a lot of people are like, you know, like I know people don't always say it, but a lot of them are like, why would you do that? Like, why would you have a relationship with somebody who had like a health condition? Mm-hmm. And I certainly had that moment when I was like, I'm in love with this person. I was like, crap, this is not what I had in mind for myself, you know? And my parents struggled with it too, you know? But he was so remarkable. And I was like, well, let's figure it out. And he ended up dying in 2017. And so I also, okay, right, the same year I met him in 2008, I got a master's degree in spiritual psychology. And that was kind of a continuation of all, you know, this personal growth work I'd been doing for about 10 years at this point. And so it almost felt like I was ready for somebody like him. And he started meditating at age 7 and he found it on his own and meditated an hour a day, starting at 7. And he'd like be like, oh, I miss a day here and there. But it's like, it took away my anxiety. It took away my panic attacks. So I like, that was all the incentive I needed. So he had a long history of childhood meditation. I mean, if he was in India or Thailand or somewhere like that, they go, oh, you're a meditation prodigy. Go and study with a guru. But he was in LA. They were like, his parents are like, okay, this is what he's doing. You know, like they just
we've got all right.
read a book about magic because he wanted to be a wizard. Mm-hmm. And it said, if you want to master your mind, meditate. And they recommended like an hour a day. And then he started reading books on meditation. Am I talking too fast?
I think you're doing great. And I just, okay. I love all of the beauty you're bringing to talking about this person who you can see, you can feel, it's palpable, the role and the purpose he held and holds still in your life and in your journey. And you held out for that person and you found him. He wasn't some mystic unicorn, or maybe we're all looking for our own mystic unicorn. But in a way, it also sounds like, and then perhaps this is the turn that's coming next, that, you know, even in joining with him with the kidney dysfunction and the too short a time together, that's also part of his gift to you.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I say in the show I created is that, like, he taught me how to love more fully and how to love myself. Cause what I mm-hmm. saw was him loving himself. Mm-hmm. Even when he would make mistakes, and we certainly had arguments, but they were clean, you know, mm-hmm. it wasn't, do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah. Yeah. You can fight dirty or you can fight.
Yeah. So it was like, oh, he can take responsibility for, you know, something that he did that was hurtful to me or that I didn't like, but I'm still, like, you know, showing up and owning that my stuff about it. Mm-hmm. But then I didn't see him punishing himself or beating himself up about whatever thing. Mm-hmm. It was like, he just had, and I asked him about it. I was like, how do you not do that? Like, I do that. I know most people do that. He goes, why would I want to do that to myself? Why would I want to hurt myself? Like, he's like, and I hope this is okay. He's like, I fucked up, but it doesn't mean I'm not glorious. It's like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. So that's like being partnered with this man. And we lived together for most of our time together. It was 9 years or 8 years, 8 months as a couple, 9 years knowing each other almost to, like, I think we met one of the first or second weekend in November of 2008. And he died like a Saturday, November 4th, 2017. So it was almost 9 years to the day. Cause we met on a Saturday or Sunday night at a charity fundraiser thing. So what happened when he died, you know, it's told in my show, but like, essentially it was different than what I thought was going to be. I was so afraid of him dying that it felt like my greatest fear. Like, I think I feared his death more than my own, you know? And it wasn't that my self-worth was tied up with him. That was important, that I had this sense of self that was developed before I met him, but certainly bolstered or enhanced or, you know, encouraged and celebrated with him, like who I am and how I show up in the world and how I express myself. But it's not that his death took away my self-worth. It was that he was my person. He was my favorite person, the one I talked to about virtually everything. And I still had other, you know, friendships and family and stuff. I didn't sequester myself with him. It wasn't like that. It was just that he was just this amazing partner and presence in my life that I could just always go to for sage counsel. He'd always, you know, I could always make my own decision, but it just was this beautiful, like, kind of perspective, you know, of like, of humans and human behavior and spirituality and astrophysics, you know, like whatever. So I just was so afraid of him dying. I loved him so much. But when he started his transition, I felt communication with him. And it was through my consciousness. It wasn't visual. I think they call it a clairaudient, but like, I knew I wasn't hearing it in my environment. I knew it was through my consciousness. And I also was aware that I could be making it up, but it didn't really matter because A, it felt authentic. And I can tell you a little bit more about that in a second. But B, it was so unexpected because I didn't feel like I was any kind of channel or any kind of, like, I'd had any of these experiences before other than feeling some spiritual guidance, like some sort of intuition, so definitely feminine energy. But I just was never, I thought that he would die and it would, he would be like gone, mm-hmm. other than our memory and in our recorded artifacts of him, you know, videos, yeah. pictures and stuff and writing. But instead I felt communication. And the first thing he said to me, so he was in a coma for like the last 25 hours of his life. They tried to do a surgery that was unsuccessful, about like what was happening with his abdominal, his peritoneal sac, because he was a PD patient, which is peritoneal dialysis. Hemodialysis is the one with the blood, peritoneal is the one with fluid in the abdomen. There's two types. And so he had all this calcium buildup, and he had like done really well with it for a while, and was taking different supplements and things, doing things, even infrared therapy to try to like just, you know, kind of reduce that calcium buildup. But ultimately with the combination of antibiotics and some pain medication, it just really like his digestion just suffered too much. Mm-hmm. And so we couldn't figure out why he wasn't going to the bathroom. We couldn't figure it out. He didn't have a temperature, even though he essentially was septic. So it was really weird how he was presenting. So they did an exploratory surgery and he never woke up. And that was a really dark moment for me, where I blacked out when the surgeon came and told me that he was unlikely to ever wake up after surgery. And about 12 hours after that, he's still alive, but in a coma in the ICU, and I couldn't stay with him because that's part of the ICU, that can't stay overnight. I heard him say through my consciousness, "It's all a gift." And it was like he was yelling. And I was like, I like argued. I was like, even your death, even this pain, like, no, this is not a gift. I don't fucking want this. He's like, yes, especially the pain, especially my death. It's all a gift. I'm like, you know, weeping. And what occurs to me, I don't know, at some point in the next minutes or days, is that that's the last thing I would have said to myself if I were making it up. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, I'm yeah. like, I don't hear that. That's not what I want to hear. So that was part of why I go, okay, this does feel like him, because, you know, and so, you know, most humans have some sort of unexplainable experience of mm-hmm. stuff they can't explain, stuff that's energy or sensation. But, and then when I presented this, I performed the show and I put it online a bit. COVID makes it difficult to like develop it at a theater. So I'm just doing what I can to just share it with people, and would love to partner in that way with other people as far as sharing this with more places. Cause I think what I've noticed is that when I share it, people come to me and they say, I had this experience with my dad or with my brother, and that I give them permission to share about it, because a lot of people just go through life and don't talk about it, even with their spouse, with their best friend, because it's so mysterious and a little weird or taboo. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the beautiful components to sharing this story, is that, I mean, so I had this experience of him communicating with me, but I still had all the grief. So I'm still crying a ton. I'm still like in physical pain about the pain of the emotions. But the thrust of what I was trying to share with you, which I take a lot of twists and turns, like a Northwest, beautiful, you know, mountain road. It engaged my curiosity. Having it be different than I thought it was going to be, than what mm-hmm. I expected, about just total devastation, just darkness, like him being gone. Mm-hmm. It was different.
Yeah.
And that engaged my curiosity, where I was like, okay, what else might be different? And so then every day it was like, my curiosity was like forefront of how I went through this experience of grief and how I continue to, because there were moments in the days after he died where I felt radical joy and something people don't always like to talk about, relief. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to watch him be sick, because that last year he was really sick. He was in the hospital a lot of procedures. Prior to that, he was autonomous, managed his dialysis well. He managed very well, even though he had a low grade pain like all the time from just aches and pains, circulation. You know about this. And so that last year was really hard, and he lost a ton of weight, and he was throwing up a lot in the last 6 months. He hardly could keep food down. He was super skinny, lost a ton of weight. And like there was trauma in that. And so there was relief that I'd have to watch him go through this, be in pain. And that was the surprise. And so I was like, okay, this is different too. That about a month, maybe a month after he died, my taste buds came back. And I hadn't even noticed that they had gone away. I just knew that I didn't enjoy food as much as I used to. And I was like, that's just, I was just like, that's just grief. Like I just kind of had a sense that that was just what, you know, what was a part of it. And I started laughing when I took a bite of a buffalo chicken wing, the spice of it and everything. I was just like, oh my God, my taste buds are back. Like, cause I think they had started to go months before, not just when he died, but like months before, mm-hmm. because I was grieving before he died because of all this stuff.
The whole journey of it. And I love listening to, I don't even know it. I want to call it like a mosaic of all the things that you are expressing right now. Yeah. Because this whole idea of everything is a gift. And that is a refrain that both of my parents have told me in a variety of different ways my whole life. And we have had some traumas here and there. And it's all a gift, but, and the way that they meant it and the way that you expressed it in this full embodiment that I could take some notes on that for myself to learn, but in this full embodiment of emotion is it a gift doesn't mean that you get exactly what you wanted, that you get the most beautiful, comfortable thing to unwrap. I think that was some language we were using before we even pressed record is this is not a fun gift to unwrap, but what you're getting from it is so rich. And part of that is this soul shattering grief, but the relief, the joy, the opportunities that come within it. And what you didn't deny yourself, and I would love to hear more from you kind of along this vein, is this is not a spiritual bypassing. This is not a, oh, honey, buck up, it's all going to be okay kind of moment. When you see it all as a gift, that means being in the moment of that awful grief and seeing what it's teaching you in that journey, having that curious spark you've carried with you your whole life make you curious about grief rather than burying your head in the darkness of its all-encompassing weight.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. It's what I see a lot of is, and our culture probably perpetuates it, is like you said, spiritual bypass, but also like substances. So like a lot of people drink. Mm-hmm. It's so accessible. It's a very accessible substance. And then I see people using a lot of distraction and like with work and stuff like that. And then I think the last one is kind of withdrawing, you know, checking out of life. And one of the gifts I didn't realize for probably 30 years is that when I was a child, I was very aware that my father, my paternal grandmother, my father's mother, was a widow. And, you know, I met her when she was, I don't know, I'd have to go back and do the exact math, but she was at least in her late 60s, early 70s when I met her when I was a child, when I first knew her. Mm-hmm. And she was already 30 years in. Her husband died when she was in her early 40s. Mm-hmm. It was my dad's dad, and my dad was only 16. That was very traumatic for him too, and he has a hard time talking about it. And it scared me how withdrawn she was, and how, as I saw her age, she died at, I think, 89, that as I saw her age, she would say things to me and my siblings like, get me a gun. I don't want to do this anymore. And that scared me as a child. I didn't quite understand it, but there was something in me that at times, especially in the most intense, I would say first 6 to 8 weeks of grief, mm-hmm. where I was just crying every day, like many, many times a day. It felt like most of my day was crying. That I felt this, I felt my body want to like go like this. And I just had this image of me like in the corner with like blankets or like just hot, like going into that dark
position.
I felt myself wanting to like close up and close in. And there was something about this reference to my grandmother that was like, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to live like that. Like, so it was like, the choice was clear, but definitely hard and something I had to choose over and over again. Like, I'm going to feel this. Like, I'm going to feel this. I have to feel this in order to be who I want to be and have the life I want, you know? And I have to feel this pain. And it's not, it doesn't mean it's comfortable. It doesn't mean I even want to. But I just was like, this is the way. Like, and that's part of why I mentioned in like why you read in my bio that it's like 20 years, because that study of personal growth and all that training really informed how I go through, how I was going through grief and how I continued to go through grief, because I was like, there are choices, you know, there are choices in how we respond. You know, one of my favorite quotes and that beautiful talk that Marcus did, 20 minutes, I did the filming. I didn't know I was making an archive of his teaching when he's like, oh, you're a filmmaker. You can film me teaching and talking about stuff. And I was like, you want me to work more outside of work? I was like, all right, you know, that kind of thing. And he gives a talk on this, that Viktor Frankl quote, between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space lies our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. And so like, it was like, I sometimes call it like a choice, that choice point, right? And it can feel like a teeny tiny like fraction of a second, or it can actually feel really big. And meditation, one of the great things about meditation, can help us expand that perception of time in our choice point. But over and over again, I kept having this sense of like, oh, okay, I just want to like close up and shut down. And I was like, and that's part of the movement stuff. It's like, I was exercising and that was really helpful processing. But I remember this feeling of just like, I'm opening to this, all the feelings of this, because I don't want to be in the corner, like, of under a blanket in the dark, you know, like closed off. And I would do things like, besides the, like feeling the feelings and like moving my body, ecstatic dance, intense workouts actually really, really, really helped. Hitting the heavy bag, which he taught me how to do, which is useful because there's some rage, you know, it's like, this is unfair. It's just like, why does this person, like all this stuff blended in, right? And like different ways of moving it and being with it. But one thing I would do is I would, like, I almost had no like shame or embarrassment for those first few months. I would like text friends that I hadn't, some of them I hadn't seen in years, and be like, I need time with people. So, you know, I'd love to hang out. Let me know what you have going on. One of my friends, he's like, oh, I'm going to the LA car show. Like, you know, the auto, like, you know, all the new cars and electric and shit like that. He's like, I'm going to the car show with my 4-year-old. Want to come? And I was like, yep. And I would work. I was freelancing. So I was still bringing in some money, but I knew that I also needed to like have time with people, engage in life. And when I was working, sometimes I'd excuse myself to go to the bathroom and cry for a few minutes just to like, get it out, like purging. And then I'd go back to work. And so I wasn't like distracting with work. I was like, I have to integrate this with work because I still have to function and do stuff. And I would be honest. That's the other thing. I'd be honest with people. They'd be like, oh, how are you doing? And I'm like, you really want to know? Like, I wasn't like, oh, I'm fine. I'm doing okay. I'd be like, you really want to know?
This is all phenomenal.
Did I go on another big tangent? I'm sorry, Carly. Yeah.
Oh, I'm gonna bring us back into a summing up, because you're showing so many great aspects of this that I don't want to get lost in the story. Because this whole idea of the choice is clear but hard. And I think of that in so many opportunities around grief. And whether it's grief of the loss of a loved one or the loss of a job that maybe meant your identity, or a child leaving the house, or living within chronic disease and illness and injury yourself, the choice is clear but hard. And can you open that gift and all of the hard choices that come with opening that gift, which is turning towards and making choices in each moment. Mm-hmm. Or in a sense, what you outlined before, the spiritual bypassing, the addiction, the distraction, the withdrawal, all of these things are ways of, in a sense, ignoring the gift and keeping yourself busy enough, distracted enough, numb enough to forget that there is something in the corner asking you to make hard choices. But what you get out of that hard choice is an opportunity to learn and bring back vibrancy in your life.
Yeah.
And outside of that hard choice, stepping into the spiritual bypass, addiction, distraction, withdrawal, numbing, is a life that becomes dependent upon that continued choice. Else you might have to open the gift.
Yeah.
You might have to deal if you take a step away from that.
Yep.
And you're giving so many vibrant and beautiful examples of what it's like to engage with that gift, what it's like to make that hard choice over and over and over again, minute by minute by minute. It's a little relentless, but it is worth it, in my opinion.
It's worth it. It's worth it. There's two things I want to talk about, like some of the outcomes and worth it, like with embracing, even if reluctantly, the gift. But then the other piece is, I just want to like tell everybody, and I have more compassion now for people going through hard stuff, as you might imagine. It's so understandable. Mm-hmm. It's so understandable to go to numbing and distraction and alcohol. Mm-hmm. It's really, really understandable. I'm not here to pass judgment on you or to like try to pretend like what you're doing isn't a valid way of coping with your grief and your trauma and your loss. Like it's, I have some, I want to voice understanding and, mm-hmm. and compassion and like to say to you, I get it. I get it. Like, it's so understandable to want to do these other things. And what I found with coaching people and with, you know, my own self is that there's so much power and glory in choosing for ourselves. Yes, there can be loved ones at stake, or mm-hmm. you know, children and spouses or parents. There can be loved ones at stake or jobs at stake, but ultimately the choice is yours to step into the emotion, the experience of these things, of your mm-hmm. of your grief, whatever it is about. And you're absolutely right. It could be divorce, it could be a job, it could be loss. There's part of my grief is loss of my innocence.
Mm-hmm.
I saw somebody die, and I've never done that before. Not really. I was around when my grandparents were sick, but not really. Not really, you know? And so it's like, I see video of me before he died, and I'm like, I'm almost nostalgic for her. I'm like, oh, look. Like, look at how sweet she was. She didn't know. She hadn't had this experience. So I just want to say, it's so understandable. It really is. Mm-hmm. And when you're ready to make the choice, there are resources, whether it's me or Carly or somebody else or something else, there are resources out there. There's support out there for you to step into feeling this and experiencing this fully.
Thank you for taking the moment to remove shame from that, because I think that is a lot of what can keep us in this place of avoidance is shame in admitting that you don't want to be there anymore. Shame of having chosen it in the first place.
Yep.
You know, sometimes it's waiting for that moment to choose the gift, and that moment doesn't necessarily have to be in the throes of the crisis, but you do have to choose it for ourselves. You know, we hear that discussion a lot in addiction and even a bit with workaholics and other distraction kind of things, is that you're not going to be able to save any of these people from themselves. These people sounded a little more pejorative than I wanted. You're not going to be able to save anyone from themselves. Let's go walk that back a moment. We're not going to be able to save anyone from themselves. Yeah. And it's knowing that that community and that support when that choice is ready to be made.
Yeah.
Be there waiting. And you sought yours out. You found your people. You asked for your people. You know, but you also had your darkness and your crying and your, you know, you weren't up the whole time. And that's okay. That's part of it. It's hard.
It's hard. And there's myriad gifts, but like one of them is that it kind of stripped away any kind of like me trying to like, and I say this without judgment, like trying to pretend for other people, like trying to put on a happy face or put on a facade, you know, like it just like, it's like, I didn't have the energy for that. Like I was like, I was like using all my energy to just be in the be like in the moment and function. And so I was like, well, you know, I don't really have energy for any facade. So I would just be honest. That was one of the gifts. And then like being able to relate to people in a different way, have more compassion, feeling the communication with him was just an enormous gift that I wasn't expecting. And then even now, so it's been a few years, almost 4 years. And like the way I show up with friends and loved ones, the way I love is like more intense even because I had this experience of this love and this loss.
Mm-hmm.
That's a profound gift, you know, of just really just savoring, you know, just the juicy, glorious, you know, connections of life, you know? Mm-hmm. I wish I could save people sometimes from their pain, but then I know that I would be taking away their experience of like discovering and connecting with themselves so profoundly that they're like I look in the mirror on a pretty regularly when I look in the mirror, which is usually at least like once or twice a day with brushing my teeth. I wear makeup once in a while, but I kind of gave up makeup with grief. I just cry too much. This is just ridiculous. So I just gave it up. But I look in the mirror and I often look in my own eyes and I'm like, oh, you, thank you. You did this with me. Like you went through this with me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so profoundly connective with self when we actually, when, as I was just saying, okay, yes, kind of surrendering to like the emotions, the joy, the fear. I mean, even I had to do forgiveness because, you know, my parents weren't as supportive as I wanted them to be. And I had to forgive them too, like as part of this process. But what's so interesting is feeling my feelings fully allowed me to understand that part of what was happening before he died was this enormous fear of him dying. And then it just like came to me just so clearly, like they were afraid. They were afraid of him dying. They were afraid of me going through this. They're afraid of coming out to California and helping me or having us come to Minnesota and having to watch him die like in their home because we talked about that and they were a no and that was really hard. It's like, oh, they were afraid. I was so afraid. So it gave me compassion. So it gave me access to forgiveness.
Yeah.
Because I understood how debilitating and how heavy fear can feel, you know? So it's like, so then my relationship with my parents has grown more rich and more honest and more beautiful and loving in the process of me forgiving them, but also grieving my loss of Marcus and grieving the idyllic image I had of them. You know, like that's part of grief too, is like grieving ideas we had that turn out to be not as true as we would have hoped, you know?
I think the grief and the struggles and the trauma and the generalized ick it is this flashlight that shines on what are the structures that we have made and that we have kind of choreographed our lives around so that we don't bump them and realize that they will fall, that they are made up. They are.
Yeah. I'm reminded of Michael Singer's book, The Untethered Soul.
Hmm.
He does a really good job talking about this, about how when we have a, I don't even know if he calls it trauma, but we have a trauma or an emotional event, especially something that stays with us, that we, it's like a thorn, like think of it as a thorn in your leg. And if you remove it, like right after it happens, it's painful. You have to clean it. it's like, it can be kind of intensely painful. But if you you're like, I don't want to deal with that, I don't want to feel that, then you like put something around it to like help it, to help, just so you don't bump it. So you don't accidentally bump it more. But then it gets like infected and pussy and spreads. So then you have to put like more stuff around it, more scaffolding. Eventually you have to get like a crutch or a wheeled thing because your leg doesn't function anymore. He's like, that's what happens if you don't deal with these emotional thorns. And I'm like,
your choreographing becomes wider and more extravagant and more cumbersome.
Yep.
Versus looking at things for what they are. And I feel like I've had so many conversations lately. I can't remember if we have said this on the podcast before, if this was a side conversation, but, we talk to people who have gone through grief, gone through addiction, gone through divorce, gone through, keyword being gone through. And myself included, with an intense history of trauma and injury and re-injury and healing and re-injury again, I wouldn't wish this on anybody. None of us would wish this on anybody. It's the cognitive dissonance of wanting to save and protect and nurture. And, you know, even looking at my little girl, I don't want her to suffer any of the ways that I have suffered. And yet, in a complicated way to say outside, I don't want her to avoid all suffering.
Yeah.
Because who we are on the other side of that going through, I love the person I have become. I do similarly to you, looking at myself in the mirror and saying, you did this. You have this strength and this compassion and this gift to share with people because, and only because you did this.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't give it back. Not a single awful tear-soaked night of it to risk the person I am today.
Yeah. And one thing, I'm not sure how this is going to unfold in my life, but I've sort of been many years formulating this, but like the what I hope and envision for our future as humans is that we will be teaching not how to avoid, you know, suffering or emotional pain, but actually how to be with ourselves with that in the educational system somehow. You
yes.
know? It's like a missing component. Like we do all these subjects, but it's like how to deal with your own mind and emotions. You know, there's a school counselor you can talk to for 15 minutes once a semester.
That's enough. That's fine.
Enough. And a lot of parents, as much as parents, of course, often usually want the best for their children, they're teaching often what they learned about how to cope with emotions and life's challenges. And so that's one of my visions for life in the future of humanity. And I don't know how exactly it's going to look for me being involved, but that I'm seeing some of it. There's like more meditation schools, which is part of it, just being quiet and present with self, you know? But my hope is that like for your daughter, it's like, of course you don't want her to suffer. You don't want her to feel pain, emotional or otherwise. And the Buddhism talks about this. It's impossible to avoid all suffering. It's impossible to avoid pain. And so then what is then possible? What's the opportunity? Well, it's for us to learn and teach each other how to be with pain and with intense emotions and with traumatic events and experiences and life's challenges. How do we be with that? How do we feel that? How do we go through it? Not around it. And I said this too. I'm open to people showing me evidence that avoiding and going around stuff or whatever means you use is effective, but I've not seen it be effective. The way is through. And I'll even say that apologetically to people. I'd be like, the way is through. The way is through. And I'm like, and I'm sorry. I wish you were different. Like you said, I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy, and I don't have enemies. Like that's not a thing, but like, I would not wish this on anyone, and the way is through.
Yeah. And so perhaps, as we kind of wind our way through this conversation, that the wish is not, because I think about it, and actually my parenting style is very love and logic and consequences are part of the teaching mechanism. So apparently I do wish suffering on my child. But
strategic suffering
is that I wish for her and I wish for our listeners. And especially as we look at a world going through collective grief and collective trauma, you know, in the wake of COVID, in the wake of climate change and the world on fire, and, you know, California air quality is still being gifted to Colorado, and it's inescapable. And so in a world that is essentially learning to need to deal with collective grief, my wish is not that we avoid it, but that we don't get lost in it.
Yeah.
We don't get lost in these woods, and instead we find our way through, and that we can all use that as a gift of compassion for each other. Because if there's anything we need, it is that gift and the joy and the relief and the sorrow as we look back in the mirror of where we've come. We need all of those gifts.
Yeah. And I'm so grateful and happy that you brought this up, because I've heard people talk about this, and that could be a very potent element of depression, that it's like you're kind of lost in these intense emotions. And, and one of the things I've been kind of reflecting on is, like, how did I not really get lost in grief? Or maybe at times it felt like I did.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are really, it's really a body component. Mm-hmm. And so what I noticed is that there are actually waves of grief where it's like more intense, and then it kind of subsides and intense and subsides. And there can be panic with grief too. There can feel like feelings of panic or anxiety. But the breath, just like meditation, the way that I have found clarity on, and I'm not sure if this exists in any books or anything. I'm not sure actually. But when the experience, body, emotions, crying, is most intense, and it feels like we're lost in it, or like we can't see a way out of it, or it just feels all darkness. Just putting our attention on our breath will give us this perception of some waves within ourselves of each breath in and out, and I think that connection can help us to crawl out of that hole of grief, of that like dark cave or cavern. So tuning into the breath is to me the most simple and fundamental way of not getting lost in grief.
Beautiful. And my goodness, if that isn't, I was just kind of chuckling to myself in my head that we could change the name of this podcast to The Healing Ground of Breath, that I don't think we go an episode without knowing that is the way. So at the risk of being entirely biased, but grounded in science, yes. And it is the one thing we always have with us, and we always have under our control in this life and as we are going through it. Katie, thank you so much for sharing your story. It is palpable, and I struggle to find the words, just how colorful and engaging your whole experience of grief is. And to borrow your phrase, death was different with you, and your beauty of sharing it with our audience. So thank you so much. And I hope people who are listening and struggling, because there's a lot of struggling in this world right now, and I hope those of you who are listening and struggling got some curiosity today and have a little bit to work with. And we'd love to hear more about that in your journey, however you'd like to share it with us. And Katie, if people would like to find you, where can they do that?
I think the easiest way is through katiestrand.com.
Mm-hmm.
So it's KATIESTRAND.com. And then you can find more stuff and contact me or my team through that. So that's the easiest and best way.
Beautiful. And then I know that you have a video from 2020 that you've referenced a couple times, and that you have offered to us before about ways to share it with our audience. So we will work on those details and invite our audience to join us on Instagram, the Healing Ground Movement there, and look for that offer so that you can see more of that full version with a special deal just for our listeners. So Katie, thank you so much for offering that. And
you're welcome.
And thank you again. Thank you for everyone tuning in. I hope you have a wonderful and curious week ahead of you. And we will see you next Monday for another episode of the Healing Ground Movement podcast. Be well.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard and got a little something out of it. Now remember, the information expressed in these interviews is for informational and not diagnostic or treatment purposes. However, I hope you find that having the right information and resources can go a long way to helping you on your healthcare journey. Ask the right questions and seek out professional help.